for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Interfacing complete. Please stand by. Now downloading Tech Talk Radio with Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ. Tech Talk Radio, it's technology you can understand. And now, here are Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ.
Welcome to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. I'm Dr. Richard Schertz.
And I'm Jim Russ.
It's been another nice week in technology. We've had some new space news, too. The big DARPA Mach 20 jet crashed.
Oh, no.
That Mach 20, we'll talk about that a little bit later.
Okay.
It will go anywhere in the world in 1 hour.
Amazing.
That's fairly fast.
Yeah,
but they have to get it to fly more than 13 minutes.
I was going
to
say, and it can't crash at the end. That's
crashing is not really an option, particularly. And I don't think it's for passengers. It's more for bombs. It's a different thing. And it was a big birthday month, actually. The World Wide Web turned 20 years old, and the IBM PC, the original PC, turned 30. So this is like,
it's birthday week.
It's birthday week. You know, I didn't realize the PC was 10 years old when the web was born. So it's like the big brother of the PCs, the big brother of the web. There's the big meteor shower this week, and this year it's online. You don't have to go outside and lay in the grass to watch
it. It's in the middle of the night, too. So that
it's in the middle of the night, but actually you can actually look at it online if you don't want to go outside. But I mean that's part of the fun,
isn't it?
That's part of the beauty of stargazing, yes. But
and you are a stargazer, aren't
you? I am
a
stargazer. Mm-hmm. Yes, indeed. I'll talk about some of the papers at the Black Hat Conference. This is when these hackers get together for 1 week just to scare the world about all the digital threats out there.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll scare everybody a little bit with their operation. And there's some effort to try to redefine the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, because it was written 24 years ago, before the internet existed, and it's just a little bit outdated in its wording. But and it was a big mailbag this week. And now it is time for...
There's a letter in your mailbox.
Oh, yeah. We not only have emails, but we also have Facebook comments.
Yes, we do.
Yeah. Kathy Skoog commented on the Facebook. She said, at the end of the show last week, you were discussing passwords with voicemail mobile accounts. I've got a Verizon service, but since getting my iPhone, I've never been prompted for a password when accessing voicemail. I was always prompted with the previous phone. Went to iPhone settings and nothing to turn on, only to change the voicemail. Would you please address this? In the meantime, I'll check it out further. Thanks. Well, your iPhone could be storing the password and then sending it automatically when you log in, so you don't have to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes the initial voicemail password is set to be the last four digits of your phone number, which, of course, everybody would know if they call you.
Right.
So it probably would be wise to change it. So just go ahead and change your voicemail password. That would be what I would recommend. Then she went on, and then she commented. We had a kind of a conversation. Then she went on and said, she said that years ago it was critical that voicemail was password protected because people could hack into your account and make phone calls. But that hole's been closed up now. And so if I only get non-sensitive voicemail messages, why do I even care if I have my voicemail account password protected? Well, if you don't mind somebody listening to all your voicemails,
right.
If you don't mind people deleting your voicemails,
right.
If you don't mind people changing your greeting,
yes.
And if you don't mind people changing the password to your account, then just leave it open. No problem.
I'd have problems with all of that, and I'm sure you would too.
I'd have a lot of, because somebody can go in and change and add a password to your voicemail account, then not even you can get in.
Exactly.
So that would be a big problem. So I would recommend that you put password on your voicemail. And actually, this is a big problem. People don't properly secure their voicemail accounts, and they put in like really stupid passwords like 1234, 111. And so you really need to have a password number sequence, if it uses numbers, that actually is harder to guess,
mm-hmm.
that not just
mm-hmm.
something really simple.
Right.
We got an email from Alex. He said, I've been listening to news about voicemail hacking, but I'm also wondering about taking over your online account. You see, the you know, if you have like a Verizon account, like a Verizon Wireless account, it turns out that you you actually could log on and you could pay your bills online.
Right.
And what you have to do though is you actually have to set up an account with Verizon in order to run that account. Now, if you actually have access to your account, you can see all of the phone numbers that you've called. You've got a complete phone log. So what happens is that many times vendors will allow you to provide all the secret information when you first log on. And you don't need much information to initially set up the account. Like, for instance, in the case of the Verizon account, if you set up a new Verizon account, you only need to know the billing zip code and the last four digits of the Social Security number. That's what you have to know. So if somebody has those two items,
they're in.
They could actually create an account for your voicemail and you'd have it. And that was also something that many reporters were doing. There's also a further problem. Like if you go to Kaiser Permanente, they've got these online medical accounts. The first time you set it up, you may need less information to actually log on. So I would recommend certainly for your phone account and for any online medical accounts to go ahead and set those up. Now, if it turns out that you try to set it up and somebody's already done it for you, then you want to call the support desk, and they'll ask for further verification, and they will then reset the thing for you. But those are two areas that, in particular, reporters were known to get access to without authorization: mm-hmm. medical records and phone records. We have an email from Alice. I've heard so much about Facebook privacy. How can I make certain that I'm still protected? Thanks, Alice. Well, actually, that's a good question, Alice, because Facebook keeps changing the rules. So you think you've got your site locked up, and then bingo, they change the rules again. So let's run through how you actually do that. When you log on to Facebook, there's going to be in the upper right-hand corner a drop-down menu called Account. So then you go down to an area called Privacy Preferences and click on that. Now, you've got a couple of areas here in these privacy preferences. You've got the first part, which is called Connecting to Facebook. And this actually shows who can search your Facebook, who can send you requests, who can send you messages, who you can see on your friends list, who can see your education, what they can see on your profile. And you can set that up either for everyone, for friends only, or for friends of friends. So, you know, you can basically make that as private as you want, but you need to go and check it because the default is probably not what you would necessarily want. Then you've got the sharing on Facebook, and this is what information you're going to share, like your status, your bio, your family and relationships, and you've got a whole group of choices there, and you can have with everyone, friends of friends, or friends only, or... Under the contact information, for instance, if you put in your phone number, and this has been a problem, if you share your phone number with friends, then people who have access to your friends' accounts can also see your phone number. So on my phone number, I share it with me only. This mm-hmm. is an option. So for the case of the phone number, you actually have a choice of everyone, friends of friends, friends only, or me only. But they don't really give me only as an option. You have to go to what they call customize. And then when you customize it, then you've got choices of me only. So you've got to go through a whole other menu in order even to find me only. It's not on the drop-down menu. It's in the customize menu. Now, the biggest issue here that I think I have with their privacy is when we go down to the bottom left-hand corner of the privacy page, they call apps and websites. Now, it turns out that applications that somebody says, oh, can my application have access to your Facebook account? These applications skim off all your data and share it all over the place. So letting apps into your system really is something that you've got to be careful which apps are in there, and you really want to watch what they do with it. So you can see which apps you've authorized, and you can edit those settings. And if you want, you can basically disable those apps or disconnect them from your Facebook account, and it tells you when they were set up. I just checked mine this morning, for instance. I found one app I didn't even know about.
Really?
So I just deleted it. I don't know where it came from. They have something called public search, where you might not want your website to show up on the public search. So you could block, you could either enable public search or disable public search. So if you're like somebody that just doesn't want your Facebook page showing up in the search engines, you want to disable that. Now, probably the sneakiest thing is what they call instant personalization. Now, all of these are under the section of apps and websites. Instant personalization actually sends your data to websites so that when you go there, they have all your data. Mm-hmm. So instant personalization sends all your data to Bing, to Pandora, to TripAdvisor, to Yelp, to Rotten Tomatoes, to Clicker. And this is probably the worst place to put it. So I'd definitely disable. In other words, you're going to unclick the enable button on instant personalization. Now, I think that that's probably the default setting, not enabled. But the problem is Facebook always changes their rules, and it might be disabled is the default today and enabled is the default tomorrow. Mm-hmm. So it's worth going periodically to your privacy preferences and locking up your Facebook page. That was a great question, Alice.
I had an awkward Facebook moment this week. I have a Facebook page that I need to get rid of because I don't use it. Somebody friended me and I didn't respond, and I ran into them at a meeting and I kind of got this look. I said, it's not because I don't like you. It's because I don't use my Facebook. It needs to go away. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry.
I know. That's the thing. Well, you know, the thing is, you can friend them, and then you can unfriend them, and they won't know it.
I wasn't aware of that.
So you can friend them, and then the next day, unfriend them.
Oh.
So it'll show that they were friended, but then they won't be notified when they're unfriended.
Well, how do people figure out they've been unfriended? Did you used to be able to figure out that you were unfriended?
No. The only way they can figure it out is if they actually go to your Facebook page, and they can't see your data because they're not a friend.
Oh, that's how you figured that out.
So they only figure it out if they try to snoop around to find out what you're up to.
Interesting.
So you could always play that game if you want to be Facebook cagey.
No, I just want to get off the thing. I want to get off the merry-go-round. Thank you.
All right. Well, we got an email from this was actually an email. This wasn't from Cameron. I'm a student at Northern Virginia Community College in Woodbridge. I'd like to know about transferring to Stratford University in Woodbridge. Do you accept credits from different universities? A way I can send my transcripts to find out how it goes. Well, I thought I'd answer this question because this is a common problem that students have when they want to go from one school to another. Mm-hmm. Yes, you can transfer credits. Credits from any accredited institution transfer. So what you do in the case of Stratford, but you do this with any school, you send an email to admissions at stratford.edu. You can go in and talk to admissions. They can actually, there are normally people at the school, and I know Stratford has people, who can actually look at your courses. And they can show how they correspond to course requirements at Stratford, and you get a degree map. And then you'll know before you enroll in Stratford which of your courses are actually going to contribute to the degree. So there are really two issues. Will the credits transfer? And the second question is, will they contribute to the degree? And this was always one of the problems when students would say transfer from the community college to a four-year school. The four-year school say all your credits transfer, and then when you get there, they say, but unfortunately, they're not related to your degree.
Right.
So you end up having credits of no value. So you have to ask two questions. Do they transfer, and will they count toward the degree? So that very good question, Cameron, and we hope to see you there at Stratford and Woodbridge.
Yep. We have a question from the studio audience, meaning me.
Yes.
Next week, this day, I'll be taking my daughter to University of North Carolina, Wilmington, where she'll be a freshman, and she needs to get a computer today. What would you suggest? Business major, and she wants a laptop.
Okay, well, I'll tell you, I think the one thing is I would get a smaller screen, a 15th or a 15-inch or a 14-inch screen, because it's much lighter. One of the big problems that students get when they want a laptop for school, they say, I want a big screen to watch movies, and they'll get one of these 17-inch screens or larger than 15-inch screens, and the darn laptop is heavy. So when they start lugging that laptop all around school, you discover after about 6 months, they buy another laptop that's smaller, and that's the one that they use all the time. So the weight of the thing is very important. And then if you got a small one, it just fits in your purse. You don't have to have a whole big item with it. So either 14-inch, 14-inch, 15-inch, or smaller would be fine. Now, I don't think you really need extended warranty because, laptops actually, they're either going to fail right away, and once you get out of that initial failure mode, it's just really not worth the money,
right.
Even though the big box stores try to sell that
yes.
to you. Now, you want a large hard drive because you actually don't know what, at least 500 gigabytes. Now, the reason you want a large hard drive is that you really don't know what they're going to use it for, and more than likely, there are going to be some MP3s on it at some point.
Right.
And they'll use it to collect their MP3s. They'll end up with all these digital pictures. They'll put all sorts of digital stuff on it. They might want to download a movie from Netflix. And so
and it's gonna
they're
going to
really be
space.
Unhappy with a small hard drive. So get at least a 500 gigabyte. And now they're even getting larger than that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think that for a college student, I would recommend getting Carbonite or an automatic backup. That's only about $50 to $60 a year. One of the biggest tragedies at school is when somebody's laptop is stolen the week before the final.
Ugh.
I mean, think about this.
Yeah.
Laptop,
all your stuff is gone.
All your stuff is gone. Laptop theft
mm-hmm.
is one of the biggest problems at college. I mean, if you just leave your laptop there, it's gone. And so if you have Carbonite, which, there are a number of automatic backup systems. They've got Carbonite. They've got Mosey. Get one of these, and then for only $60 a year, you can always restore it. So if your laptop's stolen, you can go down, get another laptop for $400, and that afternoon restore everything.
Right.
That, for a college student, I think is well worth the money, and it's certainly worth the money more so than an extended memory,
mm-hmm.
Extended warranty.
Warranty.
So those would be the sort of the main items. I think almost everything. Of course, they all come with Wi-Fi. They all are pretty much standardized. You're going to want to get the Wi-Fi,
right.
Which is going to be standard on the unit. If you want to get, I don't know if she's going to want these fingerprint detector things. I just don't think any of that's worth it.
Yeah.
Usually, what happens is that they'll get a laptop in college, and then in a year they're going to get another laptop.
Right.
Actually,
exactly.
So it's not worth getting some super duper.
Exactly.
Super duper, and get something get the extended battery.
Gonna ask you about that.
Yeah, mm-hmm. See the thing about the battery life is really the key. You don't want to be tethered to a plug because you're gonna have to carry it around school. You're gonna go to the student union. You may want to do your homework out in the lawn. I mean, you don't want to always be at a plug.
Course.
And so
when it's a nice day,
and so battery life is actually a big deal. That's another advantage of a smaller screen. The battery lasts longer,
mm-hmm.
and you can get these units with larger batteries. You know, they weigh just a little bit more, but they're just a little thicker,
right?
And then you get a longer battery life. So those would be the things. So she should probably take the unit and kind of walk around and see how it feels.
Walk around the store, but don't walk out the
yeah,
front door.
Yeah, just walk out it feels. If there's going to be a favorite bag that she likes to carry stuff around,
mm-hmm.
see how it fits in the bag, but don't walk out of the store with it in the bag.
Right.
And maybe you should tell the store clerk that you're just testing how it fits in the bag.
Maybe I'll let her go do this all by herself.
Yeah.
If she's going to walk around with a laptop
so
in the bag.
That's my advice. I got a 17-inch unit, which I really like how it looks, and I lug this thing all around
wow.
the world on travel.
Great.
And I'm never, ever going to get another 17-inch unit. It's too heavy.
It's too big.
It's too heavy. So this, I'm really giving her all of my mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wish I had a 14 or 15-inch unit.
There you go. Field tested by the doc
yes,
himself,
right.
Who's been to colleges everywhere, not just one. He's got colleges everywhere.
That's
we'll
right.
talk about that later,
yes.
too. Hey, Facebook. How do you get on the Facebook?
Yeah, go to facebook.com/techtalkonline. Facebook.com/techtalkonline. We're there waiting for your comments.
That's right. This is, of course, the aforementioned Facebook, and we're heard on many fine radio stations in the Washington area, like 1500 AM, 820 AM, 1077 FM HD2, 1035 FM HD2. We will be right back.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
My career was going nowhere.
College just wasn't working for me.
I was lost. Then I discovered Stratford University.
Stratford.
Stratford University.
Stratford helped me take the skills I already had and turn them into a career.
I'm more of a hands-on learner, and I just couldn't make it in those large classes.
I finally knew I had to do something different. With campuses in Tysons Corner and Woodbridge, Stratford helps you earn your accredited degree in business administration, culinary arts, allied health, hotel and restaurant management, information technology, and hospitality management through day, evening, weekend, and online courses. And with 10-week sessions and rolling enrollments, you can jumpstart your new career when you're ready.
Now I'm on my way to a real career.
I love my classes and professors. Stratford was exactly what I needed.
Stratford was exactly what I needed. Stratford University. Just start it and we'll help you finish. For information, call 1-800-444-0804 or check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. And now it is time for
Profiles in IT.
Yes, today we're talking about Anthony M. Fidel. He is the father of the iPod.
But wait a minute. Didn't we talk about the true father of the iPod last week?
No, we talked about the man who rejected the iPod at Real Networks.
Right.
Everybody thought it was Steve Jobs who was father of the iPod. No, he's the front man. This is actually the guy who was father of the iPod. And while he worked at Apple, Steve Jobs would not let anybody talk about him. He could not talk to the public. He was kept in the bowels of the company so that other companies would not steal him. And it wasn't until he quit Apple that all the information came out. Now he actually has a Facebook page, Tony Fidel, father of the iPod. Anthony M. Fidel was born in Detroit, Michigan, in 1969. His family moved all over the country. He attended actually 11 schools while he was growing up. When he was 8 years old, he had his first job selling eggs. He finally settled down enough to graduate from high school in Grosse Pointe South High School in Grosse Pointe Farms, Michigan. He received a Bachelor in Science in Computer Engineering from the University of Michigan in 1991, and that's when he started his first company, Constructive Instruments, which marketed multimedia composition software for children. This is software where kids could, like, make little movies and things, multimedia, make little, you know, sort of digital multimedia displays. And that company's now defunct, but that was his first attempt at a company. Ultimately, he actually started six companies throughout his career, as well as working for other large companies. In 1992, he started working for an Apple spinoff called General Magic.
Mm-hmm.
And he started out as a diagnostics engineer. He progressed to a systems architect for the MagicCat PDA platform. This was quite a successful PDA operating system that used this, where you'd sort of, if you'd want to say do print a file, print a document, you might go to the printer room. It had a metaphor of rooms. If you wanted to look up a file, you might go to the file storage room. And so you walk throughout the thing. It was sort of, you know, hokey at that time, but it was very popular. Now, during his 3.5 years at MagicCap, he worked almost continuously. He lost touch with his family. All of his personal relationships got messed up. He gained 40 pounds. And then finally, he lost 40 pounds. So he just was really so taken with making this product go that he just sort of lost all perspective.
Let himself go.
He let himself go. In 1995, he was hired by Philips, and he co-founded the Mobile Computing Group. He served as chief technology officer and director of engineering. Now, in order to work for a big company, because this guy is sort of a startup kind of guy, he demanded that his group looked just like a startup. So he got his own building. He painted the walls purple and yellow. There were open cubicles, free soda, and fruit. And nobody was required to take the mandatory drug test.
Oh, boy. Party time.
And so when he had the opening party for his group, he served as DJ there for the group. So he is quite the social bug, and he likes this startup energy. This is what he is. He's very driven. He likes the startup energy. He actually calls himself a studied engineer or a self-proclaimed designer. He has a passion for designing portable devices. He feels that when you've got very limited space, it forces you to be more creative. So this is what he loves to do. He made small portable devices at the in the mobile computing group for Philips. He's always focused on these small portable devices. So he decided to start his own company called Fuse in 1990. This might have been the second or third company that he did. Now, this one, his vision, he wanted to become the Dell of consumer electronics. You know, we had the Dell of PCs. He wanted to become the Dell of consumer electronics, where he could, you know, basically market over the internet. But the one device that he had in mind was this small hard disk music player. He said, you know, that might be a very good product line, so people could carry music around in their pocket. Well, Fuse failed to get the second round of funding. So he's running out of money, started exploring his options. So his first place, he said, you know, I'm going to go to the company that controls 85% of all the music being distributed on the internet, Real Networks, and see if they'd like a music player. It looks like it'd be a perfect match to their product line. Okay, it turns out that Tony Fadell is a screamer. He talks very loud. He's like very emotional. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that the owner of Real Networks has the same personality. So the guy hired him. But after only 6 months, 6 weeks of like conflict, banging heads, shouting matches, he left. It wasn't a good match. And I think Real Networks lost the iPod opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
So he went to Apple, was his second choice. Now, Apple was an innovative company, but they didn't really have any music. They were making Macs. And they had just launched earlier that year the iTunes, which was just a way to rip music off of CDs and store them as an MP3. There was no iTunes store. It was just a way to rip music off of a CD. And so they just released iTunes around January of 2001. And he went to Apple, told Steve Jobs about his idea, and Steve said, okay, that sounds pretty good. So he was out on the ski slopes there in Colorado, and he got a phone call from Apple. They said, Tony, have we got a deal for you? So he flew back, talked to Apple, and they said, okay, this player looks like this could be an interesting product, but we're not really sure whether we want to go with it. We're just going to hire you as a contractor. We don't want to actually give you a full-time job yet.
Uh-huh.
So they hired him as a contractor in February of 2001. And he started developing the iPod. He wanted a small device, and he was working on that. Around April of 2001, Steve Jobs said, you know, looks like this is going somewhere. Let's lock this guy up. So they hired him full-time in April of 2001 to assemble and run the iPod and Special Projects Group. So he's actually the guy that started iPod at Apple from scratch.
Mm-hmm.
He pulled together a team of 35 engineers. He oversaw the design and production of the iPod. He was also in charge of what they called the iSight device, which was their first webcam. I'd forgotten that.
I didn't know they had
their first webcam was iSight.
Huh.
So it's
a good name.
Yeah, it's a good name. That I don't think they use it anymore. It turned out there was a company called Portal Player. I keep wanting to say Porta Party.
I understand.
Portal
I wasn't
Player.
Going there.
Yeah,
I'm trying to raise the bar over
well,
here.
Well, thank you. At least one of us is. So they've been working on a prototype music device that was about the size of a pack of cigarettes. Not nearly as elegant as the iPod that Tony had designed, but they had developed very nice software interface. So he partnered with Portal Player on the software design for the new Apple Player. So in 8 months, Tony's team and Portal Player completed the prototype, software and hardware, and it had the polished user interface with the famous scroll bar in the middle. So in October 23rd of 2001, Apple announced the iPod, which had been created under the project code name Dulcimer.
Ooh.
Okay, so all during 2001, Tony worked on Dulcimer, okay, not on the iPod.
Mm-hmm.
The iPod was formally released November 10th, 2001. So look at this. He went to Apple in February of 2001 as a contractor. November 10th of 2001, the product was released. That is a quick
that's
cycle
quick.
Time.
Well, and they recognized early on that this was something that would go someplace. And that's
right.
part of the thing has been aware of the next trend.
Being able to recognize it.
Yes,
but moreover,
right.
Steve Jobs was able to create an environment for Tony that he liked.
They gave lots of soda, fruit, and drugs.
Yeah. I don't know about the drugs.
Oh, okay, sorry.
But he had his own group, and he could run it any way he wanted. I mean, he was, and so he actually was quite happy there. Now, Jobs, Tony Fadell was kept out of the picture, even though he developed the device from the very beginning. He headed the team of 35 designers. Jobs really always wanted to be the face of the iPod. He was afraid that the competition would steal his best engineers, and that's why no one could interview Tony Fadell, and nobody could interview him. There was no information on him. He was like totally devoid from any Apple literature.
The man behind the Iron Curtain.
Yeah, mm-hmm. and so it was just, they did not want anybody to know about it. Because you see, Steve Jobs learned earlier, just before when he was coming out with the Mac, he had a big press conference, and he gave these interviews about how they were going to take over the PC world with this Mac, and he got these great team of engineers coming with these new ideas, and he highlighted his engineers. Within the next month, most of his engineers had been stolen by the competition because they offered twice the salary.
Right.
So Steve said, that's never going to happen again. And he feels as though the fact he lost all those engineers is why he never dominated the Mac market. So he was always paranoid about people stealing his folks. He was promoted to vice president of the iPod Engineering Group in 2004. And in March of 2006, he was promoted to senior vice president of the iPod division. Now get this, as of April 2007, the iPod had sold over 100 million units worldwide. And this device, many feel, almost single-handedly turned Apple around.
Wow.
Because before that, it was just the Mac. And now most of the revenue stream is the iPod was the beginning, and that led to the iPhone.
iPhone.
It's a whole series of devices. Because if you add a phone, a phone radio to an iPod, you have an iPhone. So an iPhone's really just an iPod that you can make phone calls with. So this began a whole direction for Apple that really turned it around. November 4th, 2008, he stepped down as senior vice president, but he's still remaining as an advisor to Steve Jobs, CEO. So now Tony's got his own Facebook page. You can just go Facebook, tony.fadell.ipod.inventor.
Uh-huh.
I guess he wants everybody to know now that he was the iPod inventor.
Now, well,
now
that he's no left. There's no risk now.
There's no risk. He doesn't work for Apple anymore, and so he's quite the man. And he loves to design small devices. He's an interesting guy and the man behind the scenes on the iPod.
Sounds very interesting. Do you have an iPod?
We have an iPod at home.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, Marianne won an iPod.
Of course. She's won both
two iPads.
iPads and the iPod.
And an iPod, yeah. So we do have an iPod. That's yes, we do.
Everything
has been won, though.
That's truly amazing.
So I can say honestly, I've never purchased an Apple product.
That's funny. I'm still conflicted. I've told you I'm looking for a new phone. I can't decide iPhone or BlackBerry. I just the whole thing that you can't change a battery in an iPhone really bugs me.
Yeah, that is the disadvantage.
You can do that with a BlackBerry, right? You get a new battery.
You can do it with the BlackBerry. So you just have to be prepared to recharge your phone at lunch if you want an iPhone.
But I mean, when the battery, because I keep a phone for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
When the battery finally gives up the ghost for good in the iPhone, then I've got to get another phone.
Yeah, you basically because the battery is welded in, and so you soldered in, so you really can't change it. Now I think you could send it back and get it replaced.
Yeah, but it's going to cost you.
It'll cost you as much as another iPhone probably.
Exactly.
So nobody actually does that. They just get a different one. That battery life is the issue.
Mm-hmm.
Now of course if you don't use it for anything. If you don't surf the web and don't use any of the features, the battery will last longer. If you turn off Wi-Fi, the Wi-Fi really eats up battery
life. Yeah, I wouldn't use the Wi-Fi on it, and I would only surf the web on it to look for emails when I'm out of the office.
Yeah, so if you leave off the Wi-Fi, now there's somebody at work that's got an iPhone, and they bought this external battery that plugs into the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
So they carry around this extra battery with them,
yeah.
And they just plug in the bottom, and it gives them about two-thirds of a battery charge. So they have 1 2/3 battery charge, and with that... With that gets them through almost through the day. The problem is when you're on travel, you can't really tether when you're at lunch.
And exactly.
So, So it's hard to go 8 hours with an iPhone without a recharge.
Yeah, I don't like that
is the problem.
I hear you. Well, we have lots of ideas here. Some of them are good. This is Tech Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM HD2, 103.5 FM HD2. Hope you were paying attention because the pop quiz is up next here on Tech Talk.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
According to the U.S. Bureau of Labor, 5 of the 30 occupations projected to grow the fastest by 2016 are IT-related, led by network and data communications analysts, software engineers, and systems analysts. 70% of business technology professionals surveyed by Information Week say there is a shortage of IT talent in the U.S. today. However, if you have previous military or management experience, there are tremendous opportunities for you in the IT field if you retrain. Stratford University's bachelor's degree in information technology prepares you to analyze, design, implement, administer, and secure computer networks and information systems. Master's degrees are also offered in information systems and software engineering. Day and evening classes are offered so you can continue in your current field. Call Stratford University at 800-444-0804 or visit online at stratford.edu. That's 800-444-0804. Stratford University, Tyson's Corner in Woodbridge.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
It's time for Washington's most popular and longest-running radio game show, the Stratford University Pop Quiz. Now, here's your host and star of our show. No, it's not Gene Rayburn. It's not Alex Trebek. It's not Richard Dawson. It's Dr. Richard Schertz.
Welcome back to the Classroom of the Airwaves.
I'm not putting up a fight today.
We tricked you in making you think this was a radio show, but actually it's Classroom of the Airwaves. And those of you that have been good students have been taking notes, I'm certain.
Sometimes learning is like eating your broccoli, but once you've had it,
yes,
you know how good it is.
And you're so happy that you did eat it.
Exactly.
once it's gone.
Right.
Earlier in the show, I was talking about Tony Fadell. He, of course, is the father of the iPod.
Mm-hmm.
And he went to Apple back in 2001. And while he was working on the iPod, and before its release, the particular iPod project had a name. And what was the code name for the iPod project before the iPod was released?
Okay, and you can't give it to us in Pig Latin either.
No.
It has to be. And you have to get the answer to us today. So you can't send us a, you know.
You can't do that.
Snail
and,
mail.
And if you get the right answer, you get 2 tickets to fine dining to the Escoffier Dining Room.
So here's the preferred method for getting us the answer right now. That is on the phone, POTS line, if you could, please. And the number to call if you're in the district, 877-936-9333. Northern Virginia, 877-936-9333. And, of course, in Maryland, 877-936-9333.
Yes. Okay. Earlier in the show, we've got people making comments on Facebook. I was reading the Facebook comments.
Oh, really?
I'll get to those shortly after the pop quiz.
All right.
Yes, indeed.
I mention the number was 877-936-9333?
Yes,
that's the wild card line, by the way.
You certainly did.
Okay,
now, the
sure we had that
BART
out there.
Wireless service, they cut off all wireless service in the Bay Area transit system this week. It was really interesting. There was an unfortunate police officer incident where someone was shot, mm-hmm. and then there were protests throughout San Francisco. And they were all, people were rushing to the scene using the Bay Area Rapid Transit. And so the authorities went into the Rapid Transit and they went back to the wireless transmitters and they just unplugged them.
Wow.
And then after they were unplugged, they called the phone carriers and they said, oh, by the way, you don't have phone coverage in the subway now because we've just disconnected power from your units. The ACLU, as you might expect, has objected to this, saying this is the kind of practices that are done in the communist world.
And yeah.
They have no business going on in the U.S. But actually, it did turn out that the protests never happened because everybody got on BART, and then they couldn't get any further directions on where to go. So that was really the big news going on this week.
That's, you know, it's funny you mentioned that. It sort of sounds like kind of the flash mob thing that's going on in
very,
so many places.
Very similar. Yeah. Now, the Perseid meteor shower is this week. You know, every August we have that meteor shower. And this time it's very unusual in that you can get the live show online. NASA's Marshall Space Flight Center is providing live video feeds the sky throughout the night. It turns out that August 12th, which is last night, and August 13th tonight are the two highest nights for the big, big show. So tonight is a big show if you want to actually watch it. I went online last night and took a look at it, and there was rain and overcast, so I couldn't see anything last night. Hopefully there'll be something better tonight that you can see. In addition to the rooftop-mounted cameras at NASA's Flight Center in Huntsville, there are several other cameras available for live viewage around. Now, the Perseids have been observed for at least 2,000 years and are associated with the comet Swift-Tuttle, which orbits the sun every 133 years. Each year in August, the Earth passes through a cloud of the comet's debris. These are bits of ice that are more than 1,000 years old, and they burn up in the Earth's atmospheres. Perseids can be seen all over the sky, but the best viewing opportunities are in the northern hemisphere. Now, the web address for the live webcam is Perseids, P-E-R-S-E-I-D-S, .camstreams.com. So if you don't want to go out and lay on the grass, you can actually watch it online.
Around here, that may be the only way to see it because it's supposed to be cloudy today, and tonight they're calling for rain showers likely after 3 o'clock in the morning. So, and that's the time, isn't it? Is it like between 3 and 4 when it's most prevalent?
So maybe it won't be raining in Huntsville. And I also noticed there were some webcams in Europe that were available, too. So maybe you could watch it from Europe.
Watch it that way. Yeah. But you want a larger screen, not the one you take to college.
That's right. Exactly.
You know what? Let's ask the question again for the pop quiz.
Oh, okay. Earlier in the show, I was talking about Anthony M. Fidel. He, of course, is father of the iPod. While he was working at Apple in 2001, the iPod project had a code name. What was the name of that project while he was at Apple?
Gotcha. And the number to call, again, is 877-936-9333. 877-936-9333. 877-936-9333. We will get to your answers right after this break here on Tech Talk.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
My career was going nowhere.
College just wasn't working for me.
I was lost. Then I discovered Stratford University.
Stratford.
Stratford University.
Stratford helped me take the skills I already had and turn them into a career.
I'm more of a hands-on learner, and I just couldn't make it in those large classes.
I finally knew I had to do something different. With campuses in Tyson's Corner and Woodbridge, Stratford helps you earn your accredited degree in business administration, culinary arts, allied health, hotel and restaurant management, information technology, and hospitality management through day, evening, weekend, and online courses. And with 10-week sessions and rolling enrollments, you can jumpstart your new career when you're ready.
Now I'm on my way to a real career.
I love my classes and professors. Stratford was exactly what I needed.
Stratford was exactly what I needed. Stratford University. Just start it and we'll help you finish. For information, call 1-800-444-0804 or check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. We're here in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology.
We have unfinished business.
Okay, let's jump right to our business.
The phones. All right, let's go to line number one. This is Jim calling from Bowie, Maryland. Jim, good morning and welcome to Tech Talk. How are you?
Good morning, Jim. Are you there?
Yeah, here we go.
I sure am.
Oh, very good. Earlier in the show, I was talking about Tony Fidel. He, of course, is the inventor of the Apple iPod, and he had a particular code name for the project before it was released. What was the name of that code secret project in 2001?
The Dulcimer.
That is correct.
Jim, you're the winner. Very good. Dr. Schertz, tell him what
he's won. Okay, you'll win two tickets to fine dining at the Escoffier Dining Room. Just stay on the line, Jim, and leave your name and phone number with Andrew, and we'll get those tickets out to you next week.
Jim, thank you. Have you been listening to this show for long?
Yes, I've served several years now.
Excellent. Great. Well, we appreciate you calling in today. Keep listening and hang on the phone for Andrew Mitchell, our fabulous and one-of-a-kind producer. There's Jim. Let's get rid of that. Now let's move on to something else.
The web turns 20 this week. Actually, last week, August 6, 1991, at the CERN facility in the Swiss Alps, 36-year-old physicist Tim Berners-Lee published the first ever website. See? Physicist.
Yeah.
Just want to make note of that.
It didn't escape my notice.
That's why I was sort of highlighting that.
I gotcha.
It was not surprising that this basic website was pretty simple. It wasn't, you know, fancy because it was the first one. And the address was info.cern.ch, where ch, of course, is the ending for Switzerland. Now visitors can learn more about they go to the website. He explained hypertext, the technical details for creating their own web page, and he explained how you could search for web information. Now, there are no screenshots of that original page. And, of course, the only people who actually see the page are people who had a web browser where he worked at CERN. So, actually, the world at large really didn't care much about it. It was just a few people at CERN would look at his web page. And he originally did this as a way for physicists to share documents easily. Instead of sending files, they could just post their papers and their documents to their webpage and other people could look at it. So it was a way for scientific sharing of information. That was really kind of the gist of it. And that's actually how he justified working on this while being paid by CERN, which was actually a research organization. Now, gradually, the use of web browsers spread, but it wasn't until 1993 when the Mosaic browser was released that the technology really, really got serious momentum. In 1994, Tim Berners-Lee founded the World Wide Web Consortium at MIT. It's frequently referred to as W3C, and that created standards for the web, and those standards ensured that all the browsers would behave the same way, and you could actually write a web page that many people could look at. Berners-Lee is 56. He's still director at W3C. In addition to several other areas, positions that he has. So, happy birthday, World Wide Web.
And you know what? Tim Berners-Lee was somebody, of course, you remember because you prepared Profiles in IT.
That's
as
right.
You prepared all of them. He was a subject of Profiles in IT some time ago.
We have profiled, yes,
now,
Tim Berners-Lee.
If somebody wanted to know more about Tim Berners-Lee, how would they find out that information on your website?
Well, you could go to techtalkonline.com, and then you can find out our whole show outline. It's posted there. Simply go to the drop-down menu for today's show. And in about an hour after the show, I'll have the whole outline posted. And there will also be an MP3 file in case you'd like to listen to the show again.
You could
anytime.
Go back and find the show where we talked about Tim Berners-Lee and listen to that show, too.
Oh, you could go back and find that show on Tim Berners-Lee.
That's
yes,
what I was
indeed.
Getting at.
Oh,
that
yes,
was
indeed.
The idea.
Yeah, so you could actually go to the website and search for Tim Berners-Lee, and you could go back to that show and listen to
exactly.
it.
Exactly.
It was probably about maybe 2 or 3 years
it's
ago.
It's been a while.
It's been a while again. Well, it's another big birthday, Jim. This is actually big birthday week this week. This is now the IBM turns 30. On August 12, 1981, IBM launched the personal computer. Now, they revealed the personal computer at a big press conference at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in New York City, and it was a 21-pound PC. It cost $1,500, which in today's dollars, given the devaluation of the dollar after QE2, QE1, and deficit spending for years, that's equivalent to $4,000 in today's money.
Wow.
Okay? It had a huge bank of memory, 16 kilobytes of memory. 16 kilobytes of memory.
Not
holy
really.
Mackerel. I mean, now we're up to gigabytes. Here's some quick history. Now, it's kind of the history of the PC, which we'll just kind of get into briefly. It's interesting. In July of 1980, IBM's met for the first time with a young guy out in California called Bill Gates.
Heard of him.
He's a Microsoft guy, and he had just formed Microsoft, and he was writing, you know, sort of small programs out there. Visual Basic was really their main program. And they asked him about writing an operating system for the IBM's new hush-hush personal computer. Now, IBM had been observing the growing computer market for some time. They had already attempted one crack at the home PC market, the IBM 5100, which was a bust. I guess nobody's ever really even heard of that anymore. It just it never went anywhere. At one point, they considered trying to buy their way into market. They almost bought Atari, which actually had a list, which was actually selling personal computers to play games on. But they decided to stick to their own and make a personal computer and develop a brand around it. Now, this effort was led by Don Estridge.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the thing with IBM, it was a big bureaucracy, and Don said, look, he said, if I try to build this little IBM machine within IBM, all the mainframe guys are going to kill it. He said, the only way you can be successful is if we go out, we got our own little private operation, and I don't have any corporate oversight. So he wanted to make it like a startup environment, sort of the same way that that our last guy did. But he this guy doesn't have like pink walls. This was the
free fruit.
This is more of the IBM style startup.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, he did it in they got a building in Boca Raton, Florida, to design and build the Acorn.
Mm.
And by the way, this was Project Chess. This is another project designing a building. So on August 12, 1981, they released the new computer. They renamed Acorn the IBM PC, where PC stood for personal computer. I mean, it was a new term then.
Mm-hmm.
Now it means politically correct. It's been redefined.
Uh-huh. Oh, everything has been.
Now, the first IBM ran at 4.77 megahertz. Now we're up to multi-gigahertz speed. It ran on the Intel 88 microprocessor. It came equipped with 16 kilobytes of memory, but it could be expanded to 256K.
Ah.
Really big.
Huge.
The PC came with two floppy disks. Didn't even have a
floppy
hard drive.
Disks.
Two
wow.
260K floppy disks. So you'd no hard drive. Everything was on floppy. Now, what really made it different from all the other IBM computers, and this was really Don Estridge's idea, it was all open architecture, and they basically bought parts off the open market. Instead of like going in and making IBM proprietary parts, they just bought parts off the open market. And that open architecture was one reason that it was actually so successful. They chose the Intel chip because IBM already had rights to the Intel chip. They had bought rights to the 8086 chip for use in their display writer, intelligent typewriter. And so they just used the 8088 since they already had a licensing agreement with Intel. Well, IBM wasn't the first company in personal computers because Apple launched theirs, and Apple II was launched in 1977. It actually made it, when IBM got into it, it made it a legitimate device for business use. While Apple had it, it looked like a toy.
Right.
And so businesses would never get an Apple. But once IBM got into it, people said, okay, well, IBM's in it. Must be a really big thing. Later that year, in 1981, the personal computer was selected as Time Magazine's Man of the Year.
Yeah, I remember that.
So there you go. Everything you want to know about. And so happy birthday. Happy 30th birthday, IBM PC.
You know, I remember I graduated from high school in 81, and we had a computer class back then. We worked on Tandy computers, which that was an Apple product, wasn't it?
No, not Tandy.
That was
Radio Shack product.
We had to do some sort of project on the Tandy computer.
I almost bought a Tandy.
Did you really?
Yes.
Almost. But not quite.
Not quite.
You're listening to Tech Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM HD2, 103.5 FM HD2. More tech news after this.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
My career was going nowhere.
College just wasn't working for me.
I was lost. Then I discovered Stratford University.
Stratford.
Stratford University. Stratford helped me take the skills I already had and turn them into a career.
I'm more of a hands-on learner, and I just couldn't make it in those large classes.
I finally knew I had to do something different.
With campuses in Tyson's Corner and Woodbridge, Stratford helps you earn your accredited degree in business administration, culinary arts, allied health, hotel and restaurant management, information technology, and hospitality management through day, evening, weekend, and online courses. And with 10-week sessions and rolling enrollments, you can jumpstart your new career when you're ready.
Now I'm on my way to a real career.
I love my classes and professors. Stratford was exactly what I needed.
Stratford was exactly what I needed.
Stratford University. Just start it and we'll help you finish. For information, call 1-800-444-0804 or check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers, here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. We're in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. James Messick commented on the Facebook page, Jim. Uh-huh. He said, Jim, you should get an Android with extra batteries and an extra charger, and then you can just swap out the batteries. He said, extra batteries and charger cost about $10 on eBay.
But that's a Verizon product, isn't it?
Well, no, Android, you know, the Droid is Verizon,
okay.
But Android is the operating system, and there are multiple Android operating system cell phones. So that is that's really the competitor of the iPhone is the Android operating system. So those would be the
interesting.
Two. So that would be a possibility.
I can get that from AT&T then, I guess, couldn't I?
You could get not the Droid, but you get an Android version. From AT&T. Yes, you did. And
gotcha.
Jim also, since we're talking so much about Apple, he said, have you seen the new City of Cupertino, the Apple mega campus? And you look at this thing, I actually didn't talk about it. It looks like a flying saucer. It's a huge ring sort of on the top of the hill. And you look at it from a distance, it looks like a flying saucer has just landed on the ground. It is enormous. It is a very large product. It's going to be reportedly leased. It has 373,000 square feet of office space, and it will house 1,300 workers, and it will be completed in 2015. It's very, very modernistic look for Apple's new home. The Black Hat conference was last week, and also DEF CON, and so we haven't had our share of like security scares. You know, every week I like to go into our features where we scare everybody with digital threats. And the thing about this Black Hat thing is each week is that they talk about all the various vulnerabilities that are out there, and the hope is that these guys these are actually people that find vulnerabilities, report on them in the hope that they'll be fixed. One of the big news items there was that the certificate authority, which is so critical to secure socket layer and encrypted e-commerce on the web, is fatally flawed, and it's been hacked several times, and certificates have been stolen. And it needs a general overhaul to fix it because there's no true authenticity that it is in the certificate if they can be stolen and reused. So it's this authenticity and the certificate authority that keeps us safe from a secure socket layer man-in-the-middle attack where somebody intercepts your signal and you think you're talking to the website, but they get between you and the encrypted website, mm-hmm. and then they can intercept all your data. So that was probably the big news. They said Mac OS X 10.7 is a must upgrade for those who take security seriously because there are many security improvements in that. They said that's not bad. It actually holds up quite well to what they call advanced persistent threats. It performs better than the XP. And in terms of security, it's about in a dead heat with Windows 7. They said, don't use Apple's Bonjour file sharing system. It's got a major authentication flaw. Don't use it if you're in a public network. You got a real problem there. They said researchers found that many of the internet routers, wireless routers, have what they call universal plug-and-play, and they let that available to the outside world, and you could use UPN messages to reconfigure the security settings. So make certain you disable your UPnP on your system. Well, that looks like the show's about over.
Just about.
We have so much fun here.
Yes.
Listen, we want you to go to techtalkonline.com to check out the shows. Also go to stratford.edu and check out all the things that Stratford has there. And you know, if you talk to the folks at Stratford, tell them that you heard about them on Tech Talk Radio. And of course, we love your emails. So send us an email at techtalk@stratford.edu and make certain to go to our Facebook page, Facebook.com/TechTalkOnline.
See you next week.
Learn more about Stratford University Program's consumer information by visiting their website at www.stratford.edu/content_pages/view/degree-programs.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWTFM HD2 Manassas, WTOPFM HD2 Washington. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of Washington Nationals baseball, Washington Capitals hockey, the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, and American University Eagles basketball. Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m., the Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics, and your source for federal news.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers.